It's the legal edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Killian Bin Laden, Sharia Law, Imagine No Religion Conference, and the Supreme Court. Now let's begin episode 113.
And welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Of course, also heard by our friends in Kamloops on CFBX. This is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, and if you don't know who I am by now, listen to our back episodes.
And this is Daniel, vice president of the UBC Freethinkers.
So okay. How are we all today?
Ethan, you weren't here this weekend. You were hiding.
I was actually in Kamloops with our Kamloops listeners at the Imagine No Religion Conference, and boy, was it fun.
How was it, Imagining No Religion?
It was wonderful. It was just like that song.
Did you ever listen to the song entire weekend?
No, I did not, no. But I did listen to some great talks, including one by P.Z. Myers, Justin Trottier, Stuart Beckman, Jen McCrite, Nate Phelps, Krista Carlo, and Brian Dalton, a.k.a. Mr. Deity.
Does it get any better?
It really doesn't. Well, it would get better if it was, like, longer and there were more speakers. But for a one-day conference, this was pretty awesome. And it opened Friday evening with a talk by P.Z. Myers, Evolution is True, Creationism Isn't. And, you know, I was kind
That's a blunt way of putting it.
Yeah, well, you know, I was surprised because P.Z. is usually so, like, reserved, like, in his speaking, very, like, you know, confrontational on his blog. But he was really, really on his game, and there was this creationist guy who came up and asked him these, like, inane questions. And P.Z. just laid into him and was just, you know, rocking and socking them. It was just awesome. It was so cool.
I've been curious, since you've been, you know, regaling us with these tales of verbal fisticuffs. So you had a creationist there. I might be crazy, but an imaginal religion conference wouldn't seem to be something that the theologically minded would be going to. Were there a lot of people there, and were they there specifically to say, let me help you?
Well, the first talk that P.Z. gave Friday night was sort of like a precursor. It was only, like, I think, a $5 admission. And there were a couple creationists who were there. One of them went up, and she sort of discussed how, you know, her children were raised creationists and they're, you know, productive members of society. I can't remember exactly what her point was. And P.Z. said, I think it's an absolute shame that you've passed on this idiocy to your children. And, I mean, he was really blunt with it. And I think quite so, justifiably so, because it's an idiotic thing to pass on to your children. But this guy, he went to the reception afterwards and started debating P.Z. with this page of ridiculousness and sort of gish galloping him over and over again. And so I had to actually give the guy credit. You know, I would never go to a fundamentalist Christian revival and debate, like, six creationists. But this guy was standing there debating, like, P.Z. Myers and Jen McCrite and Lars Martin and, you know, myself and Fred Bremer. And he's just going on. And it's just like, wow, this guy has some serious gumption.
Well, you know, here's another thought, though. I mean, is it really that much difference than we go to the creationist seminars that have been on campus here or whatever, and we try and, quote-unquote, shine a light on their idiocy? Now, granted, of course, us having the real truth and them not, we think of them as being, oh my God, how could they do this?
Usually for those, we end up with like half the crowd. This guy seems to be more or less alone.
Exactly, yeah. And, well, it was a great conference. I thought the talks were really well done. Justin talked about the state of organized free thought. The big news, of course, is the removal of There's Probably No God signs on buses in Kelowna.
Are we going to hear more about that
later? We are going to hear a lot more about that. Trust me on that one. Stuart Beckman, who was the president of Atheists United of Los Angeles and the former president of Atheists International, talked about the Enlightenment. Jim McCrite gave a really cool talk called God's Lady Problem, Breaking Up with Abuse of Supernatural Beings. And that was a great talk. Nate Phelps, of course, is the son of Fred Phelps, who, you know, the God Hates Fags guy, gave a really emotional talk. It was, I can't even describe it. I mean, you could hear a pin drop in that theater. It was so intense. Chris DiCarlo talked about the five big questions in life. Brian Dalton discussed his show and his, he was a former Mormon, or as a foreman, he likes to call it.
A man after my own puns.
Yes. And PZ ended the night with his Dancing on the Graves of God's talk, where he discussed how religious belief is sort of like living in a world where people love tapeworms. And imagine you have a tapeworm, you get rid of your tapeworm, and if you know what a tapeworm is, it's a gross thing to get rid of, right? But instead of, you know, people being happy for you, they're like, oh, you got rid of your tapeworm. Don't you want your tapeworm back? And this is how he sort of viewed religious belief. So it was all around.
That's why we were talking about tapeworms yesterday.
Yes, because it's such a great analogy. And it was just a great, great experience. And in a little bit, we're going to jump to our interview with Justin Trottier and Lauren Price. And they're going to be discussing the Atheist Bus Ads and Climbs, amongst other things. And we'll get to that right after this commercial break here on Radio Freethinker.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Hey, joining us once again is CFI Canada National Executive Director Justin Trottier. Justin, thanks for stopping by.
It's a pleasure to be on the show again.
And we also have CFI Okanagan Chair Lauren Price.
Hi, Ethan.
So, gentlemen, we're at the Imagine No Religion Conference. I assume you guys are having a good time?
So far, so good.
Okay. Well, the big news at the moment is the sudden disappearance of the Atheist Bus Ads in Kelowna. Can you guys give us an update on what's going on with this?
Yeah, sure. Let me start on that. I guess it first came to our attention on Tuesday night, so just about 5 days ago or so, although we have reason to believe that the ads had disappeared at least a few days before that, but nobody thought to tell us, and that lack of correspondence from pretty much everybody has been part of the problem. So neither BC Transit nor the City of Kelowna Transit Department had notified us that the ads were missing. We only found out through the advertising agency we bought the ads from. They have not told us who's responsible. They have no knowledge where the ads are. They claim to be conducting an investigation, but we have no report on whether that's actually taking place. But the takeaway message really is that this is getting a lot more people enthusiastic about the campaign. Now they realize quite why it's so important. They're donating, they're joining, they're volunteering. So we're going to make the most of this opportunity.
Lauren, what about you? I mean, this is happening in your backyard. You guys put a lot of effort into raising the money for this. I mean, what's going through your head right now?
Yeah, I mean, it's just it's completely ridiculous. I mean, there's a number of Christian billboards all over the city. I mean, if somebody went and vandalized them, CFI would be the first ones out there condemning the act. We haven't even heard one condemnation of this act yet.
And what's the next move? Will CFI get more ads, and are you even confident they'll be kept safe?
No, that's a very good question. Until we get answers from the City of Kelowna about how these ads disappeared, we're probably going to be very careful about putting up more ads. But one way or the other, we're going to be continuing these outreach campaigns that promote atheism and skepticism in Kelowna. I think we have to commit to that. It's important to see this through because we have to take a stand, right? We can't let this stop us. And so as soon as we get these answers, we're going to find a way to continue the campaign, either putting these ads back up, one way or the other, I think that's going to happen at some point in the next couple of months. But then we're also going to follow up with the new ads that we've been talking about, the Extraordinary Claims campaign ads. Now we're going to dedicate ourselves to making sure those ads end up in Kelowna and Kamloops, because we see how desperately important it is that these conversations take place in these two cities.
What was your opinion of the sort of local responses when the ads first went up? Did you guys saw the media interviews, the responses from the sort of the man on the street interviews? What did you guys think of those?
That's a good question, Ethan. The press we received from this is kind of unprecedented. I mean, Kelowna's a small city, and we're getting national coverage over this. I think that shows how important this is.
Yeah, absolutely. And, just commenting on that remark about Kelowna being a small city, I think that proves how important it is. We have to make it clear that atheism, as I mentioned in my speech earlier, is not just a big city phenomenon, that there are these thriving, these quickly growing groups in smaller cities like Kelowna and Kamloops, that these ad campaigns can take place without fear of reprisal, even in these smaller areas. If we don't push this through, then we're kind of admitting that atheism doesn't belong in some parts of Canada, and I refuse to allow that to happen.
Right. So, Justin, you're someone who deals with skeptical freethought issues across Canada. What do you consider sort of the major battlegrounds? Obviously, this is one of them. What else are you kind of developing your focus on?
Well, this one is big because it does tie into freedom of speech, which is another big area that has lots of other side issues I could get into. There are other issues, of course, as well. In fact, with the recent election, we sent out a list of 10 questions, which were chosen because each one identified a big area of interest for CFI. We sent these questions out to all the leading candidates, all the candidates of the four big parties in the last federal election. We got some interesting answers back, and these touched on, church-state separation, which is a big issue, the public funding of religious schools, the public subsidization of religious charities. They also touched on some skeptical alt-med type questions. That's another area we're interested in, of course, is homeopathy and alternative medicine. So we asked questions about support for vaccination, support for putting alternative medical treatments through rigorous testing to make sure that they are effective, and also that they actually have some effectiveness to them. So these are some of the areas that I think it's important for us to follow up on.
And just to follow up on the questions you sent to the politicians, did you get an impression of maybe a political party that is more skeptic-friendly than others?
What I noticed is that many of the politicians answered frankly, and so what we have are quite varied responses. It's interesting, even from within a given party. And I think one of the reasons for that is, to be honest, I think a lot of these candidates have never been asked these kinds of questions before, which reinforces the dire need for asking them and having groups like ours lobbying on these issues. But as a consequence, we didn't really find that any one party always had the right answers and any one party had all the wrong answers. We found some candidates from some parties were very good on, say, answering our secular questions, and then maybe those candidates wouldn't be so good on, say, alternative medical questions, vaccination and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But we have opened a lot of doors. That's important. We now know at least a few candidates who are good on some of our issues, and that's a good start for us.
Lauren, you guys sent out a questionnaire as well. How did it go for you locally?
Well, to be honest, we only got two responses, both from the Green Party, one in Kelowna Lake Country and the other one in Okanagan Shuswaps. The fellow in Okanagan Shuswaps, I was actually very impressed with his answers, and I will be contacting him to see if we can build some kind of relationship.
And I think it's important to state that we're getting more and more allies, not just people who happen to agree with us, but people actually within the movement, members of movement organizations who are now running for office. We met some of them in this election, and they're not just in federal politics, they're in provincial politics, they're city councillors. I mentioned in my speech, Alex Cullen, for example, former Ottawa Transit chair and city councillor in Ottawa. Fortunately, he stepped down from politics, but he's come out as an atheist. He supported the bus campaign. He'll be giving the inaugural, the keynote address at the inaugural National Secular Supper coming up in Ottawa in mid-May. So we're really actually becoming more and more of a political lobby force, and we're really just at the earliest stages. We are getting all of our ducks in a row, as they say, and we're going to become quite a lot more active when it comes to lobbying in the future.
How cautious are you to not become partisan in politics?
Yeah, it's very important, and one of the reasons why, for example, Alex Cullen is a good choice is he's not a standing politician right now. We do have to be careful to not endorse particular candidates or particular parties, but we can comment on political issues, and we can reference this or that party or politician has said this or that in the sense of building, you know, our positions on a given social or ethical or political even issue. So it's a fine line, but it's one that we've managed to steer clear of any legal problems and still put out the secular humanist position on all sorts of controversial issues.
And speaking of politics, we just had an election recently. The Conservative government has now a majority government. This is in many ways gives them confidence, in quotation marks, of the electorate to rule as they see fit. Do you anticipate problems, or what do you anticipate with the Conservative majority government in Canada?
Well, I think that's a $64 million question, as they say. Nobody knows what to anticipate, although we've been told not to expect surprises. But, you know, what a surprise means to the Prime Minister and to the rest of us might be quite different. Without sort of commenting specifically on my feelings about the Conservative Party platform, which is... you know, which I don't really want to get into. I think that, you know, it offers us some challenges. Certainly, it changes the political landscape. The election was historic, not just for the Conservative Party, but essentially every party, you know, is in a totally different position now. Liberals are crushed for the moment, the Bloc as well, the NDP have surged, you know, in some parts of Canada especially, and the Green Party has a seat. So everybody is shifted completely around. It's going to be very interesting to see how activist groups like ours in this movement can situate themselves. But I think there are opportunities. And I think especially with the fact that we've gotten surprisingly good interests, I won't say support, but interest from right-wing media and even right-wing politicians to dialogue with us because they see us as a respectable, perhaps, opponent, but still they're open to that conversation. I think that means that we have some opportunities here that we can certainly take advantage of.
The right will often engage with us on our sort of multicultural criticisms, our notion that you know, religion and multiculturalism and culture are beyond question, whereas the left tends to agree with us more on the science issues. Is that going to mark perhaps a change in CFI's outreach?
Perhaps, although I'd say that the right is also somewhat, in my experience at least, more open to criticizing some of the alternative medical treatments. I think the left sometimes gets into the tricky position of ideological multiculturalism on the one hand and a kind of relativism that says that, you know, traditional Chinese medicine or homeopathy or acupuncture are just as right as Western medicine because there's really no such thing as right and wrong. It's all or truth and falsehood, more to the point. And so anything in that sense should be respected. And CFI's position has always been, look, we respect people, but if people have really silly ideas, then the way you respect them is you take them seriously enough and their ideas seriously enough that you go into diplomatic and hopefully productive dialogue with them on it. So I'm not saying the right's necessarily going to be better as far as creating that positive space for dialogue, but we just seem to have more invitations to at least try for that with more right-wing media. Of course, we're open to media conversations with anybody, and we certainly hope to balance that right-wing dynamic, a right-left dynamic. But certainly this current political situation affords us some interesting, I think, opportunities as well as challenges.
And Lauren, I mean, CFI Okanagan is definitely a more rural area than Vancouver or Calgary. How do you sort of navigate that split? Do you find that there's more support for your commentary on religion, or is there more support for your commentary on homeopathy and alt-med, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, that's a good question. We basically started out as an atheist group, but just the kind of the way the dynamics worked, I mean, we kind of are more shifting towards the skeptical alt-med stuff. You know, when new people tend to come on board, they tend more to be on the atheist side and kind of eventually attend a few of our things and shift more towards skepticism. So,
I think you guys agree with me in that
skepticism and atheism are not separate things. That they're really a continuum, and that a good skeptic usually is an atheist, and a good atheist should be a good skeptic as well.
Absolutely.
Oh yeah, for sure. No, it's interesting, especially you know locally here in Kelowna, that the first newspaper column that we got was it was in the Kelowna Daily Courier,
yes.
I believe. And it's going to be Professor Blythe Nielsen who will be our CFI spokesperson on that. And she's really coming at it more from wanting to educate people to think critically and to think skeptically. And her first few contributions have been on things like anti-vax and alt-med. So we're definitely going to, you know, use the media opportunities to not only push atheism all the time, but to really balance out our broad mandate.
Excellent. Well, gentlemen, thanks for joining us on Radio Free Thinker, and enjoy the rest of the conference.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will get you discounts on Main Street at Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear,
Woo Vintage,
The Kiss Store, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl,
Flaming Angels Boutique,
and The Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus, or visit us online at citr.ca.
We're back on Radio Free Thinker. Our thanks to Justin and Lauren for that. Remember, listeners, stay tuned to Radio Free Thinker. We'll have interviews with all of the speakers in the next coming weeks. But look what's walked in.
Did you refer to me as a thing? What's who's walked in? It's me, Rob, cognitive psychologist, and more than a quarter of a century old today.
Wow, congratulations.
Yes, Rob, we celebrate your ongoing decay, and hopefully you will decay long, long into the future.
Send in your birthday emails.
Hooray!
And he certificate?
He is accepting presents, I believe.
Yes, please send them to me.
Speaking of decay, and perhaps one of the more and one of the more grosser segues we've used in a while, some people may or may not have heard that Bin Laden is dead. If you haven't heard this, perhaps you're dead. So, in hearing all this stuff about Bin Laden, above and beyond the politics involved, there was a number of things I thought would be interesting for us to cover on the show. Essentially, was it legal to kill Bin Laden? I mean, Bin Laden, you know, was someone that they were out to get, but I mean, he wasn't arrested, there was no sentence involved,
yeah.
So the whole idea...
Keep in mind, legal under U.S. and international law, basically.
Well, and Pakistani law, because let's not forget what happened here.
Let's not forget them.
One of the funny things that I've noted, too, in listening in the podosphere, a lot of people have been comparing Bin Laden's death to that of killing Hitler. Now, if we ignore Godwin's rule, is this an apt comparison?
I think it was... wasn't it something like the 50th anniversary of Hitler's death or something? I don't know how it happened. But
yeah, I know.
Yeah, I believe it was. More than 50 years, like 66 or something.
But sure. It was 66 because they wanted it to happen on the sixth day or something so they could be like, 666, hooray, evil people die.
Now when we go to conspiracy theories, thank you for that Satanist link in there that we're going to have. But no, so is it an apt comparison? Well, it is credible to argue that the world is better off with both people gone, that both were responsible for thousands of people to die, and that they're both outspoken enemies of the U.S. That said, Hitler was actually a leader of a real nation that was at war with the U.S. Bin Laden was, at best, the leader of an NGO, and there's with no real legal framework around him. He was sort of the ad hoc leader, but he wasn't technically the real leader. And although it's true that the U.S. had declared war on terrorism, this wasn't actually a legal thing. It was just more of a rhetorical claim. Now, of course, it's also true that during times of war, killing your enemy leadership has a long tradition and in itself is not that unusual. A lot of people may remember the killing of Admiral Yamamoto during World War II, which was essentially a targeted assassination of military leadership. However, ironically, when I was doing research into this, at least from the Casablanca conference onward, where the Allies created the doctrine of unconditional surrender, there's actually the Allies were trying to prevent the assassination, or at least dissuade the assassination of Hitler, because they were actually worried that if they could not completely defeat Germany, that you would have had the stab in the back sentiment that had occurred after World War I, and that this might actually cause a reemergence of German militarism and ergo a World War III.
And hence that Tom Cruise movie where he played a one-eyed Nazi.
horribly, from what I understand, too. Now, of course, another difference between Hitler and that is that Bin Laden actually has been charged with various crimes in U.S. courts. And that, according to U.S. law and U.S. Constitution, that if you can't actually punish someone who's been charged with a crime until they're actually convicted. Furthermore, if he becomes in American custody, that amplifies it again, that they are actually committing a huge American crime. Once you're in American custody, you can't touch him until there's actually a conviction, irrespective of who he may be.
Yeah, you have to follow like the due process guaranteed in different like the Constitution as well as other articles that the U.S. has done.
Well, how does it work for soldiers who are killed in battle during wars? Could this have been an instance of that sort of thing?
Well, that's where like the big thing that comes into it is whether the U.S. sort of went to capture him, but then ended up having to like defend themselves because he fought back.
Yeah.
In that case, I mean, it's pretty clear that like it wasn't illegal for them to defend themselves when someone's fighting back at them. It's very dubious to argue that. They'll admit that it was a capture or kill mission.
Well, yeah, actually, and what makes this. Leads us on this point is the whole idea that U.S. policy right now has a policy of targeted killing. Now, targeted killing in itself is the assertion made first by Israel. Actually, in 1973, they went out and they assassinated essentially the Munich terrorists who attacked them there. The U.S. since 2002, and even the USSR recently, has this idea of targeted killing. That according,
so did you say the USSR recently? They don't really exist anymore.
Oh yeah, that's right. I mean Russia. Whoops. Well, Putin is trying to restore the former Soviet Union.
This edition of Radio Free Thinker coming to you from 20 years ago.
Actually, yeah, no, I think it's more than 20 years now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. That being said, that so targeting killing, that apparently under specific, albeit vague, circumstances, and yes, specifically vague is an oxymoron, that governments can authorize the extra-legal execution of particular individuals who are deemed enemy combatants. Now, of course, the term enemy combatant is rather ill-defined. And in the past, again, you know, as you say, if it's on the military field, if you're actually part of the military structure, you're considered a combatant and therefore fair game. But with the rise of terrorism and all that, it's become quite murky as to who qualifies.
Well, it's unconventional warfare, yeah, is what we're talking about. It's similar to like the Vietnam War. Mm. This isn't, it's not like a game of chess. This is like, you know, a completely different style of combat altogether. And the old ways of understanding war don't sink in with this current style of conflict.
Yeah, what counts as an enemy combatant when, you know, months beforehand, the American ops have tons of intelligence that they find out where Bin Laden is hiding and go there directly in order to capture or kill, as they say.
Yeah.
Like that's way different from two people, you know, lining up on either sides of a valley and then running and shooting.
Yeah. Loading the muskets.
Well, true, but I mean, the Geneva Convention explicitly prohibits the targeting of specific civilians for assassination. And I know the idea of what is a civilian, again, becomes murky. But, I mean, that's the whole thing. I mean, do we just sit there and say now anyone who is remotely connected somehow is now fair game? I mean, in the United States, there's a huge debate going on about one particular person who is involved, who's been accused of, and take note, accused of training other people to be terrorists, to do terrorist acts. But this gentleman, one, is in Yemen. Two, he's an American citizen, so he actually is under their constitutional law protected, right? But, I mean, do they have a right to kill him? And take note, we use the term targeted killing, but we should also remember Bin Laden's attack is actually quite different from most targeted killings because it was a bullet to the head. Most of these are drones that blow up a building that usually take out the guy that they're after, often the number of people besides who are not part of the targeting, and more times than they'd like to admit, a number of innocent people who, even when you stretch the term of enemy combatant, doesn't really follow.
Yeah, and it should be mentioned that the U.S. specifically chose like a special ops team to do this rather than like a missile because they wanted to confirm that it was Osama bin Laden dead, basically, rather than if it was a missile. There'd always be lingering questions about whether he was actually killed.
You know, and actually, speaking of confirmed, this kind of leads us into the next sort of aspect that this bin Laden assassination has kind of brought up, is in the United States, there's been a whole bunch of people saying this is a big vindication for torture, that torture was the only reason that they found him, and that without torture, they never would have found him.
Hold on. I thought that there was some congressman or even a press release from the White House saying that none of the intelligence acquired for this mission involved torture at all.
Just to show you how confusing it is, Donald Rumsfeld, who, of course, is famous for initiating enhanced interrogation, as they call it, first came out and said that no, you know, waterboarding or enhanced interrogation had very little to do, if anything, to do with this. It was good ground footwork. And then, of course, about an hour or a day later, he was on Fox News saying, well, what I had meant to say. And then he was on another news program clarifying his clarification, and it's become quite murky since then.
Yeah. It looks like, and this is largely coming from a New York Times article that sort of has summed up what people have said so far, that sort of two pieces of information that may have had some hand in finding the whereabouts of Osama bin Laden that came from torture was the carrier, that's the person who would take messages to Osama bin Laden, take them back to other Al-Qaeda operatives.
Courier,
yes. His fake name, basically like his, almost like his handle name, which basically led to very little. This name came in 2002 and led to very, very little. Like, if it was really a smoking gun, it wouldn't have taken 9 years to get to him. The other thing that may have been more important that did come from some enhanced interrogation, and I'm air quoting here because I hate that term, came when sort of a vague description of what the courier looked like from someone else who, I believe, like face like isolation and other types of torture.
I find it funny. Most of what I've been hearing from this, and again, it's kind of hard to know now, has been like confirmation bias, right?
Yeah.
Is they sit there and they said, well, one of the reasons why they knew this courier might be it, because when they mentioned the name to the some people they had in, locked up, is they said that he wasn't anyone, and that they knew that if he was denying that this was an important person, that made him an important person, which to me sounds like that's, Monday morning quarterbacking. It's like, you know.
Very, very classic case of fitting what you already think you know to what you've just seen.
Another important thing to keep in mind is that many people faced enhanced interrogation. The person who experienced the most was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, number three in Al-Qaeda. He was waterboarded over 180 times. And basically never gave up anything useful. He gave up stuff, but most of the time was really misleading. Like, he would give out names that turned out to be basically, like, nobodies and sending, like, the CIA on, like, year-long, like,
well, there have been people who have basically said over and over again over the past several years that torture doesn't really give you anything useful and doesn't work.
Well, no, and that's actually a thing. So even if we did assume that they did get some information from torture, right? As Rob is pointing out, I mean, empirical evidence has showed that torture doesn't give you good intelligence, and that intelligence you do get is so unreliable and so compromised, you can never really be sure if it's actually accurate or not in the first place. But even if we did assume that it was and it was all valid and we'll give them all their credit, there's still, it's a philosophical tool we use in philosophy, called counterfactual. That's why it's a philosophical tool. The counterfactual for this basically says, well, okay, even if you did get it from torture, that doesn't mean you could not have gotten it through other means that would not have involved or has been as costly, both ethically as well as materially, to the way that you did get it. And again, evidence points that that was a viable thing.
Yeah, it's important to realize that when you, in essence, like kidnap people from their country and then ship them off to Guantanamo Bay to torture them, you're not exactly like
following the rules of the Geneva Convention?
Well, yes, but you're not exactly like making these people like you. Like, it's very conceivable that every time you go and torture someone, you're just going to send more people off towards like the grips of Al-Qaeda.
Well, I mean, plenty of people have jumped on Osama bin Laden's death and released, you know, to the public tapes and messages saying that, we were his protégés and now we're really mad and now we're going to take revenge attacks.
They're going to have to wait, though, for the United States government to give that promotion. I mean, the fact that Osama was number one and the doctor, I can't remember his name, is number two and the sheikh is number three, none of that actually existed in their organization. These were all positions assigned to them by American intelligence.
Who's going to be on the Ace of Diamonds?
Yeah. So the Ace of Diamonds, right? So that being said, another thing I thought was kind of interesting that's kind of fallen out from this is, okay, so now that bin Laden is dead, does this change our whole thing being in Afghanistan, right?
People have been calling for us, you know, mission accomplished, several years after they put the banner up saying so. We should just get out of there now.
Yeah. Well, I saw a really funny comic. It was like Obama calling up George Bush, and he's like, so where did you leave that mission accomplished banner that you used?
Well, you see, the problem is, I mean, for the Americans, you know, this whole getting rid of bin Laden was sort of their raison d'etre, their purpose for being there, right? But, I mean, like with so many missions, it kind of changed with over time. I mean, originally, it's like capture bin Laden. Then it was, let's remove the Taliban. Then let's stabilize the nation. Then it was prevent the return of the Taliban. Then it was nation building. And now, as Rob's kind of hinting at, it's like, we've been here for so bloody long, we have to do something to justify us having been here.
It's the sort of thing where what people are doing now is that you know, they're trying to close this chapter, as it were, on basically a decade of life with bin Laden out there hiding. And I saw something really interesting on Boing Boing, I think, the day after bin Laden was killed and it was released to the media. There was about, I forget how many, but there was a lot of Google searches, and about two-thirds of them, based on analytics from Yahoo's search engine, were between the ages of 13 to 17, and they were searching for things like, who is Osama bin Laden? And it was all over Twitter with these kids basically didn't know who Osama bin Laden was.
Well, let's be fair, though.
Didn't know, like, basically everyone knows the name. But
they don't know his significance.
No, but let's be fair. This was Yahoo's search engine, a much inferior search engine to Google. This episode brought to you by Google. When you need to know, look at Google.
The point I'm making is that there's only a certain subset of the world's population that actually cared all that much about this. And now that it's over, what reason do we have to carry on?
Well, actually, see, ironically enough, I came up almost with the opposite thinking, that as Canadians, we kind of think now of our mission in Afghanistan is to rebuild or help rebuild Afghanistan from a quote-unquote sort of repressive government, i.e. what the Taliban was. And, of course, acknowledging the fact that the current government that's sort of there with NATO's blessing is almost as regressive and repressive as the Taliban was. But that being said, that bin Laden's death in that sort of aspect is sort of irrelevant. I mean, he's just sort of a footnote to the whole mission, really.
Well, I mean, like you guys have been saying, the mission definition has been re-described so many times now, there's no clear objective to why forces are there. And there's no historical precedent that we can draw on where we said, okay, well, back in, you know, the 40s, we occupied such and such. No, it doesn't compute. This is basically the first time that Western powers have occupied a country with no point.
We could look at the USSR's attempt in Afghanistan.
Well, technically, it was there to support the current government to maintain the government. Well, yeah.
That was more of just an invasion than a withdrawal. I mean, it wasn't... This is a protracted occupation that has no point and no exit strategy.
Which, of course, just shows you why it's such a murky thing. One of the things I'm really looking forward to, in a very negative sort of sense of looking forward to, is the conspiracy theories that are going to come out of this. I mean, obviously the
first... There already
is. Yeah, no, obviously the first ones that I've been hearing about is, oh yeah, Bin Laden's been dead for years, and
Obama's just not come even
out,
dead.
Obama's just come out with this because of the election, which the timing seems a bit weird.
The funniest thing that I heard was people were saying that he's not really dead, and I think Michael Shermer called them deathers.
and people who haven't been believing the death images that the White House has been debating whether or not to release. I'm not sure if they've released them
yet. I don't think they have. No, I think that's all a hoax.
I love how ridiculous the argument, like, that the U.S. would lie about killing him, because he could just release a picture of himself, like, holding a new newspaper, and it would be so, like, humiliating to... like Obama and anyone in the
I expect someone to Photoshop that image for us immediately.
Actually, I've got this one covered because apparently with the moon mission, right, everyone said, well, you know, the Soviets, and it was the Soviets at the time, would have exposed the Americans if they hadn't actually gone to the moon. But they say, no, the Soviets didn't do it because they were all part of the big Illuminati conspiracy. So Bin Laden is part of this whole big grand conspiracy.
That's a new one.
some of the things, though, that I think are important to take note of, and again, I think these will be made into things themselves. People have complained about how quickly he was buried, right? I mean, well, buried at sea. Part of that is because they did actually want to bury him with his religious protocols, and part of that is you have to be buried within 24 hours. They did, apparently, as good as you can, do everything else according to his religious tradition. And secondly, they also, of course, wanted to make sure that there was no point of martyrdom that people could focus around. So, I mean, I am kind of interested to see a bunch of Muslim fundamentalists in the middle of the Indian Ocean focusing around this one spot they kind of think is where Bin Laden is buried. Yeah, that's not really funny, but kind of horrible if you think about
it. There is historic precedent for that. They did the same thing with Hitler's body as well. But, well, let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with more after this.
Yes. Bravo. Yes, indeed. This is going to make your world a lot different than the one I grew up in.
You know what?
CITR.
Yeah? Sure, it's over there.
And over there is where that sound is coming from. Right, Mr. Marconi?
Through the air, across the ocean, the first time ever.
The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
We're back on Radio Freethinker here on CITR.
And speaking of Muslims... Osama bin Laden, for the horrible, evil person that he may or may not have been, was a Muslim.
I'm glad to see that the segues are just as good as when I was a regular contributor.
Quiet you.
In the corner. Literally realized that Rob was actually here right from the start, but we didn't let him out until he promised to behave nicely.
I'm sorry.
So
they tied me up.
A few months back, there was a lot of talk, especially in the States, about the idea of Sharia law and how it was imminently going to take over the U.S. Some people remember here in Canada a few years ago, there was sort of the same debate in Ontario about Sharia courts being set up. So it kind of led me to ask myself, what's going on here? You know, what is this Sharia law thing, and should we? Is Canada going to become a legal theocracy? So I thought I'd look into it.
Are we already a theocracy?
We certainly don't have an official separation of church and state.
And no. Our head of state is the head of the church.
Actually, I don't. Is it the head of our church?
Well, the Anglican church.
Yeah, it's our Constitution does say we are a country formed under God, which repulses me every time I think of it. If you guys really want something to change the Constitution, change that. Screw Quebec. Sorry, Quebec. So first of all, there's a difference to be made between, you know, having Sharia law as the law of the land. There are countries like Saudi Arabia and Iran that have legal systems that are based on Sharia law. The whole schmozzle is based on Sharia law. For the most part, their laws are more or less similar to us. They have speeding tickets. You know, if you do this, you get... their legal systems are very similar in most ways. But there are, of course, some notable exceptions. For example, adultery, you get stoned. If you drink alcohol, you get whipped or flogged. Or if you steal something, you can have your hands chopped off. For those in reference, Saudi Arabia did this in 2007, Iran did in 2010, so these aren't historical footnotes. These are things that still can happen to you this day. But because these legal traditions are sort of based on the Abrahamic traditions, they are also all very patriarchal and biased against women. In the same way that you get with canon law or rabbinic law.
Yeah,
so they're not unique in that way.
A lot of the times you hear about these stories are not just like, you know, getting your hands chopped off or stealing, but most of the time when it's in the media is because of the gross mistreatment of women in these countries because of Sharia law.
Right. And as I was pointing out, because it's a religious-based law, it's not so much unique to Muslim countries. It just happens to be that's where religious law has the biggest foothold. You had the same thing when you had canon courts. You had the same thing when you had rabbinical courts to varying degrees. That being said, when people say that Sharia law is coming to Canada or the U.S., they do not mean that our current criminal law system is going to be replaced with Sharia law.
Because there's no way anyone would let that happen.
No. Well, it's against the law in many countries, in some states in the States, and in a province. I'll tell you more about what province later. The role of Sharia law, of course, is used in civil arbitration cases. So there is a place in civil law where arbitration is used. Now, arbitration itself is the process where two parties in a civil dispute, such as a disagreement on the terms of a contract, may select the third party to hear both sides of the case and make a legally binding settlement on both parties. Who gets to be the arbitrator is determined either by the original contract or by mutual agreement, as well as the method of a rule of thumb that the arbitrator uses in order to make his decision.
A lot of the time when you're buying into a tech contract by some phone company or something like that, often there's a little provision in there that puts you into forced arbitration if you have a problem with the contract, rather than going to court against the company.
Exactly. Capitalism and it's... Anyhow. So basically what this means, with regards to religious court, as long as we have the idea of arbitration, anyone can agree that the arbitrators happen to be holy men and that the rule of thumb that they used is religious law. In the same way that we could sit here and pick William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy as our arbitrators and say that they have to use the prime directive or Starfleet commands as their rule of thumb. The arbitration that we have in here
is extremely geeky.
Well, no, but it is. They have complete freedom as to how they do it, with the one caveat that the arbitrator's decision can't actually contravene Canadian law. So the arbitrator can't say that one person becomes the other person's slave, or the amputation of limbs, or that sort of thing.
They also can't. They can't go against the sort of the. There's no real good legal way of saying this, but sort of the feelings within the charter. Like, there's a strong precedent that if it sort of feels anti-Canadian, a higher court can change it, like change the ruling.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
It's not in the law.
What a great debate. No. Yes. No. Yes.
So anyhow, that's
where argument clinic.
we have legal experts currently frantically searching this up, and I am sure they will let us know by emailing us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. So we have that basic idea of arbitration with Daniel's supposed caveat. Although I don't know if I'm going to go with that, but. Isn't it nice we disagree on things other than libertarianism?
Is everyone who's saying that, oh no, Sharia law is coming to Canada,
it's a false controversy,
because
essentially.
Because they can't actually, you know, all of the provisos in Sharia law that would be discriminatory or extremely violent can't contravene Canadian law.
Actually, there is a place, though, because again, as I did a bit more research into this, one area of civil law that does become problematic is family law. So family disputes like divorce or child separation, child support, and that sort of thing is considered to be a civil dispute, and as such can be subject to arbitration. And this is where religious courts come into conflict with civil society. I mean, as we mentioned before, religious courts do tend to be very biased towards men, and rules based on religious texts are often discriminatory towards women, leaving them a victim of the proceeding itself.
And additionally, if you're already relying on a religious court, you're probably very indoctrinated already, so you're not going to go and seek outside help. In this situation, you're probably going to be stuck with whatever ruling this court makes.
And this is where it became a huge issue in Ontario, because they changed their arbitration law to read that, quote, under section 32.1, it is provided that the parties under arbitration are free to choose the legal framework by which disputes will be settled so long as the result is not prohibited by law. And again, that means if you're in a divorce, you could say that the woman is not allowed to file for divorce, or that she gets nothing, or as long as you...
That's not true. If it goes against the equality provision in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and it can be reviewed by a higher court.
Well, will it be reviewed by a higher court if neither of the parties bring it forward?
Obviously, one of the parties has to bring it forward, but ultimately, it doesn't become legally binding if it's against the Charter of Rights and Freedoms.
Right, but how do you determine what's Charter of Rights and Freedoms?
The Supreme Court does.
Right, which means that the wife can get nothing in a divorce. I mean, that doesn't contravene any right. There is no right. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but that's what I mean. When you have who gets the children? Religious court says the man always gets the one. How is that revoking constitutional charter rights?
Because if your rule is every single time the man gets it, the rule is not. It's not fair. It doesn't meet equality provisions. If the rule is more like, and this is where it could be hard to argue, if they don't outright say that that's the rule, but just always give it to the man, give the children to the man, then it becomes
legal
harder.
Quagmire. Is there an existing case that we can look at or look up online somewhere?
Well, actually, the only thing I could find that was actually a case involved was a local Vancouver woman who had lost her get. And a get, ironically enough, is a Jewish divorce, which led her to wonder whether she was truly divorced or not. But in BC, our laws, the BC law, says that in family disputes, arbitration isn't actually something that's allowed to be used blanketly, that it has to actually conform with the other laws, has to conform with Canadian statute law.
So you can't choose an arbitrary framework for your
exactly.
Arbitration.
You have to actually use the Canadian legal framework, which is why, and why me and Daniel are having the spirited debate. I love spirited debates. Ontario actually had to change their law in order to add the provision that, where is it here? They added the thing that the rule of thumb for any legal provision with regards to family law had to be conducted exclusively in accordance with the law of Ontario or of the Canadian jurisdiction, because if you're getting a divorce in Ontario but you're from Manitoba, you can use Manitoba jurisprudence.
Doesn't that basically say that the rule of thumb has to be the actual law?
Which goes back to, and where me and Daniel are now going to be on the exact same page, which goes back to this whole thing about Sharia law being, we have to be all worried and everything, reverts back that if in family courts there's a higher standard to ensure things like equality and unbiasedness, then the idea of a canon court or a rabbinical court or a Sharia court is merely a literary fiction that just disguises arbitration. And arbitration is something that, first of all, I don't believe in religious courts under any circumstances. I think that's offensive to me. But if you're going to give the idea of arbitration its fair shake, then I can't see why you would deny it to one group and not to another. Ironically enough, because even though this is, as we said, sort of a false controversy, although a lot of people do kind of bring it up, Quebec has banned all religious-based arbitration, even though it was already banned in their civil code. Quebec doesn't actually follow British case law. It actually uses a civil code like they do in France. Another thing that's interesting, and not really in our scope of discussion today, but I was also looking up, is the idea of Aboriginal sentencing circles. Now, this is kind of a quasi-spiritual, quasi-ethnic sort of thing, where sentencing of natives is done through a sentencing circle. And this was done in order to provide, like I say, a culturally sensitive sentence for Canada's Aboriginal population who have suffered from institutional discrimination in our legal system. I mean, if you take a quick look at the level of incarceration of natives, you can see that there is a systemic inequality in the country, and part of that is, again, historical. But the way these sentencing circles are set up are quite different than the idea of religious courts or arbitration. And again, if there's any interest in that, please email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com, and we can do a segment on Aboriginal sentencing circles.
You know, I do agree, Don, that it is a false controversy in that we're not going to see these courts active. But I think it is telling when a community tries to invoke these, because to me, like, this, the fact that these courts are so misogynistic in the first place troubles me to no end. The fact that there are people trying to establish these and essentially have, you know, control over women in their society is, I think, very counter to, you know, Canadian culture and society. And then in addition to that, like we said, legally, they can't cut off someone's hand or something like that. But if we're talking about someone who is already disenfranchised, who doesn't, you know, go out very often, doesn't have access to Canadian legal representation, these courts can really abuse them.
I think, and just to play off this, and where, again, as true atheists, to be the Scotsman that I like to be, we have to be careful, too. I mean, they use the term Sharia law, but that's where you have to worry about, you might be being manipulated by those who are more in the racist or, you know, Islamophobic mm-hmm. sort of crowd. Because what Ethan's talking about applies to any religious type court. I mean, a Mormon court, if they exist, like I say, they're canon courts. There is an active rabbinical court that's, what are they called? They're called Beth Din. And apparently those are quite common. Well, Jewish communities have been around for a while, but they have a very active role in their community, and even if they don't have legal force of weight, they do have cultural force of weight, which is what Ethan is getting at.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like I said, I think that's something that we should try to keep our eye on. I mean, as secularists, obviously we want, you know, one legal system that makes sense for everybody and not a bunch of little weird ones that operate independently sometimes.
Yes. That being said, In the Bin this week is going to go a wonderful little segment I had done on the Supreme Court, but we might have that next week or next week. But seeing as Rob is here, and Rob is desperately want to get his FaceTime or voice time, Rob, what's on your mind?
Well, what's on my mind is an impending deadline. It's not just that the show is supposed to end in approximately 4 minutes, but also I have a couple of essays that I have to write that are due on May 13th. And in true academic style, rather than writing these essays, I started looking up about the psychology of basically procrastination and deadlines and how impending deadlines change our perception of time. So some research out of the University of Swansea in Wales, in collaboration with the University of the Netherlands, entitled So Much to Do in So Little Time, just published in Psychological Science this December, looked at how deadlines affect time perception, specifically how much the amount of effort you have to put into something changes how far in the future you think it is. So previous research has done things similar, like where the spatial perception of how steep a hill is influenced by the amount of effort you have to put in the task. So, for example, you perceive a hill as steeper if you're wearing a backpack full of stuff, or if you're really tired, or if you're older.
Pulling a big boulder up it.
Things like that. So I guess the researchers here decided, well, how does effort impact time perception? So they got a whole bunch of students, and they had them imagine a whole bunch of events occurring at some time in the future. And some were easy, like going to pick up some concert tickets. Some were hard, like plan an entire wedding. And they had them rate how hard each of these events were, and also rate how far away they thought they were in time. And it turns out that the harder they were, the more difficult they rated them, the more effortful, the further in time they appeared to happen. So what they decided to do next was, let's do the same task, but give people fixed deadlines for each of these events. How would the actual deadline affect your time perception? And suddenly, the hard stuff, the stuff that took more effort to complete, like planning a wedding, felt closer in time than the stuff that was easier. So there's a weird reversal here, and they tried to figure out what's going on here, and in order to do that, they had another study where they primed how difficult or easy the task they had to do was. So they're giving a task to keep track of their food intake for a month, and then at the end of it, they had to submit either a half-page report or a 10-page report, and they were given the same deadline. Well, it turns out that when they had a 10-page report, the deadline seemed to loom a lot closer. So what they think is happening here is that psychologically we conflate effort, the amount of effort something takes, with the amount of time something takes. So effortful events fill in the time period with more stuff that you have to do than less effortful ones. When there's no time period given, we spread the effort out over more time. So something that is really effortful seems like it's further off in the future. But if you're given a deadline, that same amount of stuff is filling up that compact period of time, and so it seems closer, because there's a whole lot more stuff you have to do in a very fixed period of time. So, in essence, what I'm doing is procrastinating more by talking about this. But there's a deadline, and that's the end of the show coming up right now.
Wow, very good, Rob.
You know, I must admit, I hadn't really planned for it to work out this way, but you're... pressure for time, working out with your talk about pressure for time, was brilliant. I'm a brilliant person.
Yeah. Well, I'm just going to ignore all that evidence and take my time with our skeptical highlights this week here on Radio Freethinker. Coming up on May 22nd, which is a Sunday, the UBC Freethinkers have their Breakfast of Champions at 10:30 a.m. at the King's Head Pub, which is always a nice time to have breakfast and chat about skeptical topics.
So if you plan breakfast 2 weeks in advance, that's...
Yeah, there you go. You have a deadline now, and it should be easier to do.
It's very difficult to eat.
I have trouble planning my breakfast for tomorrow. My big thing is following Quebec's lead in the Orange Crush. People may or may not know there is a by-election happening in UBC's riding itself, Point Grey.
Vancouver Point Grey.
Happening tomorrow. So please get out and vote, unless, of course, you're someone who I don't politically agree with, in which case, take the day off and just have a nice, wonderful bike ride.
Or if you live slightly out of the riding,
yeah.
You can't vote, sadly.
Yeah, that always happens.
I was reading the 24 on the bus today, and I saw a little thing in the back of the back pages saying, here's the headline, 1 in 10 moms give babies herbal remedies, researchers find. And at first I thought it was going to be fairly uncritical of these kinds of remedies, and it was saying, you know, chamomile is considered one of the best supplements in addition to relieving colic, blah, 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 blah. But the very last paragraph is, since herbal supplements aren't as strictly regulated as other drugs, it's recommended that parents consult their family physician before administering them. So skeptical kudos to the 24.
Ah, oh, well done.
And take note, they also said herbal as opposed to homeopathic, because, I mean, as we mentioned, herbal remedies can actually be medicine, right? I mean, aspirin comes
sure.
from, you know,
yeah.
it's not the same, oh my God, you have to be nuts if you believe in herbal remedies that we get from people who say, I believe in homeopathic remedies, in which case...
Well, homeopathy isn't herbal anyway, so... well, our show is wrapping up, so I do encourage listeners, though, please email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT, and we have a whole bunch of new Twitter followers following the Kamloops No Religion Conference, so join our new friends and follow our tweets and that kind of stuff.
Did you tweet them saying hi?
I did, actually, yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah. And, of course, check out our blog at www.radiofreethinker.com. And my name is Ethan, your freethinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Rob saying have a good evening, and this is my last show while I'm still in Vancouver, because I'm going back to the UK on the 12th.
Bye, Rob. And this is Daniel saying happy birthday, Rob.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, folks.